Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes. And this time, this is episode number 85. And we are going to talk about a very short book called The Source by James Michener.
I felt like I was on an enforced march through the history of Israel.
Yes.
Except that it was good. Just that relentless, why did you leave it for 1 month? 1,200 pages or whatever.
Yeah, my copy's got 900 pages.
Yeah.
And very small type. But boy, was it good.
Yeah,
I absolutely, mine is very small type. I really loved it.
Now, what made you pick this book?
I don't, you know, I can't even say for sure. I bought this book before I picked it. No, I hadn't read it. Okay. Before I picked it, I was at a bookstore, and I picked the book up, and I like James Michener. I've read one or two of his before. And then I started to read it, and I got into it probably, I don't know, 50 or 75 pages. And then I said, you know what? I think that this would be really great. And I think that you had mentioned it in the past as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that just all clicked together. And I was surprised at how well it clicked in with everything. You know, we were talking about the Holy Land and all that.
Right.
And here we are talking about it some more.
Yeah.
But it just felt like the right thing to pick. I can't explain it really, but
it was great.
I really liked it. It was.
I read it. Gosh, I must have been high school or college, which is, you know, more decades ago than I really care to think about. And I was stunned at how well I remembered a lot of the first part of the book, especially. I mean, it had powerfully gripped my imagination when I read it.
Hmm.
So that all these years later, I was going, oh, yeah. And then he says this. Oh, there it is. It's really unusual in that way. And also, I think I was looking around at reviews on Goodreads, and people there who've read a lot of Michener, which I've only read one other of his books, one about Afghanistan, that's a real short one, it's a fairly early one, had said it's doesn't go in chronological order, you know, because he's going back and forth between modern and ancient times. And they said it's real unusual, and they think it's one of his best for that reason, actually.
Yeah, so what's the one about Afghanistan?
Oh, it's called Caravans.
Wow.
It's terrific.
I really need to read that. Yeah,
I picked it up because I think I was interested in trying some Michener, and that was a short one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually the story of a young diplomat who is Jewish, but his name doesn't reflect it. And he gets sent to Afghanistan after World War II to be part of the American diplomatic mission there. And so that's a good way for them to describe to everybody what it's like in whatever big city they're in, whatever big city there was in World War II, after World War II. And a rich American's daughter goes missing. And he's sent to try and find her. And it turns out she's very attracted to the nomadic life and the people, and for a variety of reasons. And so what happens is he winds up going from to smaller city to tiny town to meeting the people that she's interacted with there to being actually on a caravan with the nomadic people. So he takes you through Afghanistan that way. And although it was short, it was really effective. I felt like I understood a little bit more about the place when I was done.
Yeah, that's definitely going on my list. I've got to read that.
It was good.
Cool.
And short.
And short.
Did I say short?
Define short.
I was like 300 pages.
300 pages, okay.
I think. Yeah. I don't know. To me, that's short.
Yeah, yeah. Well, compared to these. Compared to his other books. I mean, most of his books are huge.
Well, and this was, I loved the way this was put together because it's got the framework of modern times, which would have been, 65 or 67? And it's people going to an archaeological dig and at a tell, you know, an archaeological site that they can tell was a city in Israel, and they need to find some good stuff so that they can keep the money coming in from the rich person in Chicago who's funding them. So as they dig down, they find various artifacts and date them. And then as the story goes on, that framework continues, but what happens is he then goes back in time and starts with the very oldest thing and then tells you the story of each of the people who owned or left that stuff there.
Yeah.
And as a way to tell the story of a land, it's brilliant because you get so involved in each of these little, I guess you would call them novellas, really.
Yeah, that's what I would. Moment. This is almost a collection of stories.
Yeah.
With a framing story in it. So the book was published in 65.
Okay.
The tell, all the sections about the modern time in the 60s is they're called the tell. Mm-hmm. And an interesting thing to note is that the tell is called Makor, M-A-K-O-R.
Yeah.
And it's actually fictional. Yet most of the things that he talks about that are around it, like Akko and mm-hmm. things, are actually real. And he has an explanation at the opening of the book that tells you that. So he makes up a archaeological site called Makor. And then through that archaeological site, he starts to tell the story of the Jewish people, really, from the very early, very beginning. It's like, you know, he has a book called Hawaii, and I haven't not read it, but I've read like the opening because it's funny. It's like it starts off with, you know, there was a volcano. Once upon a time, there was a volcano. So here in the source, he just talks about people that were at this site. And this site progresses through a time. So the book, other than the framing story, it is in chronological order.
Right.
Each story takes place at a certain period. And he tells you what period in the title, or, you know, there's usually a map of what Makor looked like at that period in mm-hmm. history. Mm-hmm. Just fascinating.
A little drawing of what they found with the notes on it that the people made. And then the other thing that's effective about having the modern story kind of be a framework between the other stories is that these people, Israel is a fairly new country at that point. And so the people there who are working on it, the main ones, are a Catholic archaeologist from America who's trying to understand, you know, as it comes to him, all this stuff, a Muslim Arab who's a local. And they follow the one family line throughout. You're not always sure who it is as each novella starts, but when I would identify, ooh, here he is, or she is, who's part of that family line of the original ancient caveman, you're following that family line at the same time. So that's interesting to see throughout time how all these descendants go. But a couple of Jewish people who fought for Israel's freedom, or I don't know if you call it freedom, but I fought for it to be there, literally fought for it. And they're on the dig also. And then against that is put the framework of this kibbutz that is nearby that's providing a lot of the labor and support, like food and all that kind of thing. And so you've got all these questions of religion, of how this nation should be structured, that I'd forgotten that anybody would have had to think about all that.
Mm.
And I didn't enjoy where in the middle of each novella, he breaks in with the tell's observations about it. I finally get to the point where I skipped that stuff because to me it broke the story rhythm. But in between each novella, I did enjoy it because that would kind of, it would kind of comment on a few of the things of the time.
Yeah, it would comment on, you know, observations about the specific thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I agree with you. I enjoyed that too. And I think that he used those short breaks in the middle of a novella. It was almost as if the novella itself was more than one story.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd break it in half, you know, using a little bit of that. And then he'd start over. Yet it was in the same timeline, but maybe from a different point of view or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Or time moved on.
Yeah.
Instead of the clock or the moving calendar pages.
Right, right. So the sweep of history is something that I just have to mention, because I don't know that I've felt this way before while reading it. It must be absolutely amazing to stand there. You know, they're talking about Diana and her Holy Land visit and your Holy Land visit coming up. How amazing that's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, because there is just something about standing there.
Well, that's the thing. I was thinking about that. And Diana at The Faithful Traveler, for anybody who doesn't know, she does a video series that's on Catholic TV. And then she just got invited back by the Israeli Tourism Ministry to be a behind-the-scenes observer and documenter of Pope Francis's visit recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's going to do a pilgrimage in the next spring, she and I.
That's great.
And and one of the places we're going to go is Akko. And I went, oh my gosh, I just was reading about rabbis talking there, you know, when I was reading that. But one of the things I was thinking is she had somebody tell her that you haven't read the source, you need to read it. And I thought, you haven't read the source? Oh my goodness, because having read this, I feel like I'm going to just stand there feeling the weight of time around me. All the thousands and thousands and thousands of years of history that of this place being a crossroads, essentially.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, you know, we who live in the United States, it's not that there haven't been people here. There have been people here, but it's not always obvious that you know, this place was inhabited by someone 3,000 years ago.
Right.
But yet, you know, when you're over in the Middle East, you know, the place from which civilization really sprang, to be around there and just to think of everything that occurred. And then Michener does that with this tell at Makor. And it's intensely personal. Especially, you know, at the very opening, to imagine yourself or just imagine what life was like then and how similar humans were then and now, you know, that we are all humans. I recall when I first read, something like Socrates, and I realized that people, you know, before Christ, were dealing with the same issues as we are here.
What?
It was both disappointing and comforting at the same time.
Right.
You know, disappointing in that, you know, have we not figured this out yet? And comforting in that, well, those were people. You know, we're all people, and we can recognize the humanity in them. And we can recognize the humanity also in the earliest Stone Age people that Michener opens the novel with after the first section about the tell.
I remember watching, oh gosh, I can never remember the name of this, that Werner Herzog documentary about those painted caves in France.
Yes.
It's called The Cave. Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah.
We'll put a link. But
The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I think.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And I remember looking at that, and he's, you know, going on and on with one of his little imaginings, but I was thinking, these people, because they were like, we think they did this for like, was it 30,000 years or 300,000? It was some incredible time period that people kept coming back to this cave and adding to these beautiful paintings. And I looked at them and thought, those people are the same as me way back then. Because it doesn't matter why they put them there. They painted them. They expressed them as art. And that was that moment of identification, to the point that when in this book, fairly late on, I guess it's toward the very end, where they discover the skeleton of the caveman, and they're like, they weren't human, is the person is thinking. I think it's Tabari is thinking, well, they weren't really human. But there was something about them that was human. And I was like, I had read the Bee Eater's story. And I was like, no, he was completely human. Wait. I mean, I really identified with him a lot. And so Michener, I think, did a really wonderful job of finding the humanity in each of these people he's showing us, who are very different people a lot of the time. And what their concerns were and what they were trying to do in life and in just living.
Yeah, and it's interesting what we have in common and mm-hmm. what our differences are. You know, clearly I've got concerns that the bee eater did not have. You know, yeah. And part of the effect that that has is, why am I so concerned about this stuff when, you know, the bee eater is worried about survival?
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't worry a lot about survival if we're lucky enough to live in a place that we don't have to worry about that. But yet, you know, early people, that was their main problem, you know, and I'm worried about my phone. It makes me feel quite silly.
No, though, because I think one of the things that he's doing is one of the things the bee eater has to deal with is his society changes in essence. Would you call it technology? But when his wife starts noticing that the wheat grows better in one spot and that she can harvest it, I mean, because he's also telling the story of mankind's development in many ways, especially here. And I like when he's like, well, the field they had was like a few grains of handfuls of grain thrown down by the river. But to them, it was huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he suddenly, they're living in their own house so they can keep an eye on the wheat. He's not living at the cave.
Yeah. And that's a big deal for him. So he married a woman whose family would wander around. And he is used to staying in this cave, which is marvelous. Isn't this a wonderful cave?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, we need to move down by the river and we'll build this thing that we'll live in.
Yeah.
He's like, what are you talking about? We have this cave. And he's talked into it. And that's a huge, big deal for him to mm-hmm. exit the cave. And it's a metaphor for, you know, all of humanity doing that. You can feel, Michener makes you feel as if all of humanity is moving out of the cave.
And then
all of his feeling, you know, the elements, the weather, mm-hmm. Destroying crops or knocking his house over or whatever, makes him wonder, well, is this a good move? and you know, how many times do we hear that in our lives too? Everything is like, is this really a good move? This yeah. next step in whatever it might be, you know, maybe the previous way was better. And then surely you've got people in two factions. So even back then, it's kind of the same. You know, baby steps along a line, whatever this right. line might be. And people saying, I don't know that that's a good idea. I think we should stay here because we're safer.
Well, or even just because it's not that he's safer necessarily. I mean, that's part of it. But a lot of it is he misses the comradeship of everybody sitting around together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, it's a change in how people live. And he's having to deal with it. And he articulates it really well at one spot where he says, and then one morning, as the grain approached its harvesting, who's the bee eater, cried suddenly, "That's it." "What?" his wife asked, looking at him suspiciously. "We've been trapped into putting all our energy into wheat." "What do you mean, trapped?" she asked, caught by an ugly suspicion that had discovered her own source of fear. "When we have all the grain in one place, it can easily be destroyed." And so then they're like, well, now what do we do? So then they've got to start thinking about that. So he really articulates well the way somebody might have felt and been able to think about it in those leaps, as well as humanity's steps in that direction.
Right. So I'm looking at my book here, and it says that this is right around 9834 BCE.
Golly,
so about 10,000 years ago. I remember a long time ago reading that about
that's before Christ, so
yes, yeah,
after we've had more thousands, right?
Right. But I recall reading a long time ago that somewhere around 10,000 BC,
uh-huh.
there was some kind of a shift in which people started to bury their dead.
Oh, yeah,
you know, they're starting to find graves kind of all of a sudden, and anywhere that there's humanity. It was almost like a light switch turned on and suddenly people are burying their dead.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that fascinating. So this is from that period, you know, 9800 BCE, which is a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, and in fact, when they find his grave at the end of the book, he has been buried with a few things, a few things to go with him, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. I marked a paragraph that I just loved. It says, "Then came the great days at the well, the kind of days that men in all societies know occasionally, the few days that make the many years endurable. Ur's wife and son worked the fields and found new ways to make the earth produce. The sun shone upon them approvingly, and enough rain came, but no more. The others in the cave thought it significant that these two were growing enough grain to feed almost the entire cave, and husbands began to ask difficult questions of their wives. Why can't you do what his wife did? Ur's daughter cared for her firstborn and wished that another bird would fall to her care, but none did. The lovely bee-eaters flashed through the wadi and created larks, or crested larks followed the reapers gathering grains. Sometimes a deer would dart across the fields beyond the rock, and owls would call from the cypresses. How good these days were."
Wow.
I love that paragraph.
It does sound wonderful, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you know, we're all in search of that. And we all have those times, right? Peak moments. Times when things just seem to be going just perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
And you're lucky if you can stop and spot it and say, yeah,
yeah,
this is terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And at the same time, when they'll talk about, you know, what the wife thinks, especially because she's more involved with the grain, they're dealing with the same problems that we deal with. She's worried about what happens if the grain fails. The bee eater he's plagued by ideas of, like when his son-in-law dies is the ultimate one, but they have bigger questions than just, am I going to get enough to eat?
Yeah.
And the problems that come up in their lives or the things they might worry about are the things that push them into considering more, thinking more, reaching out more. And so, of course, Michener uses this to show you the supposed way that religion would start, or the way that a Catholic or anybody of faith, I think, would say is the way that God starts to reach out so that you can understand him, which is kind of how I looked at it. And I looked at it and I just went, oh, I love this. This is the appreciating God in nature, and here's what they can understand. So here's what they grasp of that reality. You know, the fact that there's some force bigger than them that they cry out to, you know, when the river's threatening the grain because it's flooding.
Right, right.
Sort of thing.
Yeah, and his wife is sort of who suggested that to him, too.
Right. You know,
this is the way to look at that. And, yeah, it's really interesting. That's another, you know, one of the things about the book, you know, it's progression through history. It's also from this starting point. The development of religion as well through that.
Mm-hmm. And Judaism specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
Although Christianity and Islam are also mentioned later.
Yeah, they are also in there.
Later.
Did you happen to see that prayer for peace that they did at the Vatican with
I didn't.
Pope Francis and the President of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority? It was really interesting because in the service, you know, how do you decide? They didn't all pray the same prayers. It's like we have our own thing. So they did all three. They did Israeli and or Jewish, Catholic, and Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And they did them in that order. And the reason given was because it was chronological.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, I thought it was nice.
Well, it's interesting because during the reading of this book, there was a prayer that I came across that struck me so much that I printed it out and taped it into my quote journal, which was, I think it's the prayer Pope Francis said when he was was it a Holocaust memorial when he was in the Holy Land, or he was meeting the Holocaust victims, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Those six people.
Yeah, yeah.
And his address was like a, I would say beautiful, but it was heartrending also, a lament to God of why do we act this way? You know, why we're so sorry, God, that we contribute to the worst things and destroy the creations that you've made, including man. And it wasn't long, but it was powerful. And I was right at that point, I believe I was reading about the Crusades. But throughout this book, once you get past that first section, you're continually seeing signs of people striving with each other and how awfully it can turn out and the consequences for everyone, which makes it sound like a doom and gloom book. But the Crusaders chapters really struck me on that. And I was like, yes, yes, this is also an appropriate lament to go along with the book.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, you're right. It is. There are some very difficult things here. You know, in the name of religion, just the conflict that occurs. I recall, I don't remember which section it was, but I recall a number of Jewish people laying down. I'm pretty sure it was Romans. And the Romans wanted to bring some icon in, and the Jewish people laid down on the road and were prepared to die rather than have this be brought into their town.
Right. That was, I think, I don't know how you say his name, Egal and his three generals.
Yeah.
I have a printout of the, of the chapters.
So it's amazing to just think of, I mean, that conflict. And part of me thinks, well, geez, why don't they just stay alive and not, and just allow that to come in, you know? But it's so difficult. I don't even know what I'm trying to say. It's like a part of me felt, well, what is the point of this? Why can't they just allow it? Yeah. Why can't they just allow something like that to occur? Because it's not really hurting anybody.
But they did. They allowed it and allowed it and allowed it. And here was the final result.
Right. And that's where you get to. My exact point is that, you know, you give some, you give some, you give some, and then eventually it's gone. And now you're dealing with the eradication of your way of life
or your faith.
Something like that. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because the other problem is if you start off going, no, if we give an inch, you'll take a mile, there's no flexibility there.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you become so rigid that you're at the point you were at when at the end of the book back in modern times, there, you know, nobody can get married in that country in Israel who hasn't got the rabbi's approval. And so even people who don't actually really fall under their jurisdiction, if you've been divorced, you can't do this. You have to fly to Cyprus and get married, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so you wind up with, you've got to be more flexible. But how do you do it before you get to the point where you're having to lie down in front of the tanks, essentially, which is what Egal and his three generals did? Because the thing I also liked about all these stories is for a certain amount of them, Michener allows God to be a player, basically. It's not just a secular point of view. And it's not just them going, well, I think maybe if we stick this large stone up, then the rain will stop. It's, you know, by the time you get to an old man and his God, which is the third one, God is speaking to his people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're responding, even though they don't understand what's going on. And so he allows that to be there without trying to explain it away. Because this is the experience of the people of the land. They do these things based on what God tells them. Like one of my favorite stories was the voice of Gomer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is this old Jewish woman who she's had a horrible life. But the one happy time in her life is her son is grown. He's doing well. He's married a beautiful pagan girl. But this girl treats her like Ruth treated Naomi in the Bible. And she does everything for her. And she's closer than her own daughter would be. But yet when God speaks, she's having to, you know, shove her away and separate her from her son. And it's a crucial moment in Jewish history. But what you see is it played out through this one person in a way that's just simply heartbreaking. but she can't deny what God wants. And he also stops and steps back and says, here's why God does it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed the same thing. And it's interesting to look at that, you know, because it's such a fine line. I mean, this could have gone off the rails at any time. And that's one of the things that's so amazing. You know, you could go too far one way or too far the other way. Mm-hmm. But yet that didn't happen, you know? And then what you're talking about, you know, it sure can be seen as, you know, a guidance or an influence. It's just amazing to think about.
Well, yeah. And the way he tells it, there's no just guidance or influence. Like mm-hmm. For example, in that one story, she's like breaking water pots because she's hit by a vision from God of what she has to do. He's telling her,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you know,
right.
you have to go do this. She's like, well, I don't think I've got to go get water today. I don't want to hear this. She's resisting as much as she can. And that happens, you know, in several places where the people are like, well, I'll do it, God, but later. And he's finally like, now I'm going to talk to your son instead because you're not doing what I want. And he will. This has to happen.
Yeah. I remember that. I don't recall which story it was, but yeah, this man whose son comes back and says, oh, I had a vision.
And he's the like, old man and his
he's
God.
Like, yeah. He's like, what? You know, why didn't I have that vision?
Like, I gave you a lot of visions,
right,
old man.
Right.
You kept putting it off. You tried to make peace with everybody. And I'm telling you, you have to choose one way or the other.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately that's too often the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we've kind of talked about the Bee Eater, which we mm-hmm. both loved.
Yes.
I mentioned the voice of Gomer, which is, for one thing, that story, and what this book does is too, by the time you get done, you feel like I'm not Jewish or Israeli, but I now understand the deep love and attachment they have to the land there, if nothing else. And that's one thing that when Gomer and her son, God wants her son to see Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles because he wants him to have that memory always, and which this book makes explicit. It's God wanting this to happen. And she says, can a widow go to Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles? Who would build her a booth? And she's talking to, oh gosh, maybe she's talking to her son, I guess. And it says, he could not see her face, but it had become transfused with yearning. Like many Hebrews of her generation, she longed for Jerusalem as bees long for spring to open the flowers, or as lions trapped in the valley hunger for the hills. It was the golden city, the site of the temple, the focus of worship, the target of longing. No other city in the world until the advent of Rome would have the profound effect upon its adherents that Jerusalem had upon the Hebrews, and this in spite of the evil days that had befallen the land.
Hmm.
And somehow in talking about how she longed for it that way, it suddenly made me connect more with that. Because I don't have that feeling of longing to see a place, even though I'm going to go on this Holy Land pilgrimage. I imagine I will come back with that feeling, mm-hmm. but I don't have that feeling going. I can't think of a place I really love Chicago. You know,
I like Chicago too.
And I would like to see New York, but uh-huh. I don't feel that way about it. It's not to my bones, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. I can't say that I do either. But yeah, I can understand, you know, the feeling of home and seeing a place as extremely important in that way. Yeah,
but
interesting.
If the temple is there.
Yeah, Makor is very near Jerusalem, right?
Yeah.
I can't remember how far away, but that's one.
Well, and this is also when you really kind of start to feel in your bones that I've always heard Israel is not that big.
Uh-huh.
You kind of really see it here, too.
Yeah.
People are zipping around like crazy all the time, walking here, walking there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not, I don't think it's that far. Yeah, it's relatively close.
That's nice. Yep. Yep, very cool.
Yeah. So you also liked, another one I thought was
there was one called earlier. Yeah, the Psalm of the Hoopoe Bird. I was fascinated by that because it's about an engineer who comes up with this idea to make the place safer. They want to build walls around the city, but the well is outside the walls. So in order to make that safe, he comes up with an idea to run a shaft down to a tunnel that would go to the well and then cover up the well so no one would ever find it. And they end up doing that. And I just loved the description. You know, the ancient engineering is just a fascinating subject. You know, how did they build the pyramids and all that stuff? Mm-hmm. But how these guys did the tunnel. It was a big, long tunnel. And how they lined it up and started to tunnel from two different directions. And they wanted to meet in the middle. I was so happy when they met. I was like, hooray! But yeah, they would line them up very carefully and then they'd start digging and guys would go down with hammers when they felt like they were close and start hammering on the walls. So because they felt that they could, they should be able to hear each other and then they wouldn't hear each other and it was very disappointing. So they kept digging and then finally they heard each other and you know, the signaling that they would do between each other. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that.
The way they were sighting from the outside to try to plan it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that they could then dig under the earth. I had never thought about having to try and figure out which direction is which down there because you got no compass.
Yeah, they didn't have anything like that.
Well, and also this one brings up something that you see again and again of like minds that spark at each other's intellectual friendship and just, you know, they understand each other and that's right. Him and that slave.
Yeah. And that is a huge aspect and it's a lesson for life, something that we see all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they're from two different backgrounds and, you know, yet they're friends and they connect intellectually, like you said, they enjoy what they're doing, but sometimes society still pulls that apart. And that was heart wrenching, you know, mm-hmm. You know, because they, you know, well, one was Muslim, right? No, not Muslim.
No, he was,
what was he? What was a slave?
I thought it was just, the slave was Jewish.
Okay.
Or whatever, whatever that was.
I don't recall why he was different.
He had helped again in the rebellion against King David? Or against somebody, and the general knew him, and he was a slave because of that. Right. And then, he put his life at jeopardy in order to stay and work on this project with his friend.
Right.
By the end, he should have left, and he was urged to leave, but he knew he needed to stay.
That. And King David actually shows up in this story.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah, late in life, but
that's it. Well, yeah, because was it? Yeah, it was him, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then he had been in the fighting against King David, I guess. And so, or against one of his generals, he had killed somebody important.
Right.
And in the war.
And it's not to be forgiven. Right.
Yeah. And he pays for his friendship with his life.
Yes, he does.
But it's worth it to him to make sure that his friend has his project done.
Mm-hmm.
As well as his own involvement in the project. But he stays for his friend.
Yeah.
And you see that also throughout is the friendships that people form or the attachments or connections that people form through all these different stories that they have to choose. What are they going to do?
Yeah. And you know, that's incredibly unfortunate. And then when you're at modern times at the Tell, at the dig site, you've got a Jew, a Catholic, and a Muslim that are constantly having these conversations trying to reach understanding. They're not at each other's throats in any way. They're just simply explaining, especially the Catholic trying to understand the Jewish faith.
Right.
And how, you know, deep it is.
Well, and I love the fact that the descendant of the family line of Ur is actually the Muslim Arab.
Yeah.
And he's the one who's kind of always translating because he understands both sides a little bit better. And he's always going, oh, you don't understand, John. These people, this is how they look at it. A Muslim like me knows this. So you're getting always him kind of translating those different points of view. And the thing I thought rang false in the book was how everybody was pursuing Vered, if that's how you say her name. And none of it seemed, it was all too fast. I mean, I understood her connection to, I can't say any of these names, and I apologize, Eliav, the Jewish guy who was in charge there. But they weren't in love. They admitted they weren't in love. They were going to get married. And instantly, the Catholic archaeologist is like, well, I think I should marry her. I'm 40 years old. And that's where it seemed kind of dated. Time for me to marry. She's adorable. I'm taking her. You know, you're like, what? And her, then her reasons for, at the end, for choosing the way she does. And it was interesting to watch her be able to abandon the Holy Land, which she had, or, you know, Israel, because she didn't care about it being a Holy Land, because she was able to take her energies and transfer them elsewhere and want something different. But none of it was based on love or affection.
Yeah.
Seems like.
Yeah, it didn't seem like that either.
I was like, I feel like just a man went, I have to I have to do this. This has to be.
I do admit that that was the least interesting part of the book, and
because it was like,
ho-hum, you know.
Yeah, it was, because it was the most unrealistic. All these stories had people who had genuine feelings for each other, whether it was love or hate. You know, like I loved the one, the saintly men of Safed.
That was so well put together.
And it was a longer one because it's showing you three different rabbis who are from three different places where they've been spread during the diaspora, I guess you'd say. And so it shows all of them being persecuted in different ways, where they are able to say early enough, we have to leave now. Something horrible is going to happen. It's going to escalate. So they all make their way to Safed, which is a nearby town to Makur. And they wind up all representing different aspects of Judaism. You've got the mystical side with the Kabbalah. You've got the Ashenki, is that it? Ashenkanism, which is the more intellectual part at that point, and the Shepardim, I guess, is the most lovable guy ever, who's got the worst wife in the world and the worst family. But
and
but
that chapter is like 1400 AD, 1450 or something like that, is what I'm seeing. Yep.
But you feel like you know all these people, because the one of the things I loved about it, though, is it's showing you all their family situations, and how also all these strains of Judaism are kind of struggle against each other, and they have to work together in order to not just touch off this, I don't know, like today would be called a flame war between the different kinds, different branches. People, well, my rabbi says this and my rabbi says that. So they're shouting in the streets over it. And I was thinking, you know, people who look at Catholicism or Christianity from the outside will see that kind of thing, and they're just like, oh, blah, 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 blah. You know, you guys can't get along. And on the one hand, that really should be the case. But on the other hand, in a sense, if it's done in the right way, not in the way that's happening in Iraq right now, it's the sign of a healthy religion. It's people who are actively engaged in their faith and in kind of hammering out, what does it really mean to live as God's person in the times we live in right now?
Yeah, that's a great point.
What are people, what are people allowed to do? What are they not? What is the point where you have to lie down in front of the tanks, so to speak? Now, people escalate way too early these days, in my opinion, thanks to comment boxes. But
Yeah. But that's a great point. And again, you illustrate what he does again and again. What is there, 17 stories or something?
Yeah.
That he manages to really give you a great picture of the people. I mean, the characters. And, you know, every one of them's got people to care about in it. And very well drawn, very well written. Again and again and again, he does it.
Yeah, and although I complain about some of the dynamics of the tell story, by the end, I was actively engaged also. You know, in how were people going to get married? What was going to happen? He did carry on, in my opinion, some of these little dialogues too long, where he'd kind of break them down into Israeli, American. And I'm like, these are all legitimate arguments, but I think there could have been a shorter, easier way to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
But when they were digging down to the cave level, that was the part that gripped me by the throat.
Mm-hmm.
Here was the descendant from 300 generations or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Finding his ancestor.
That was something else. That was something else.
And the way all of them went to the cave to kind of sit and think and reflect on whatever. It was really touching, that
part.
It
really was, yeah. It really was.
It was that reminder that we're all connected to that early caveman. We're all the same in that sense. The humanity hasn't changed. It doesn't matter what social system or how we understand and try to be our best, which is what people who aren't religious have in common with all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since we're talking from a Catholic point of view, we're all trying to do the best, hopefully, in the light that we're given. We're just lucky we have the Catholic Church.
Yes, indeed.
Sorry, I had to say it.
Hooray. Yeah. So, trying to think of some of the other things that happen, you know, in Christian history. It doesn't talk much about Christ at the time of Christ. Although there's that interesting chapter, the King of the Jews was an interesting, it was different from all the other ones. It was very short, it was like a letter.
Epistolary, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting.
But he does mention Christianity occasionally, and of course I haven't marked, but I won't be able to find it. But at one point he talks about what Judaism is offering mankind versus what Christianity is offering mankind. And it's like, well, Christianity, God's using Christianity to allow men to individually, experience him more. Judaism is the touchstone against which everything else is kind of measured.
Mm-hmm.
As a societal thing. It was, gosh, I wish I could remember it. But so every so often he would touch on that sort of a general comment. And he does the same later when Islam arises, which is much later.
Yeah, yeah.
600s or so. And in this book, that's much later.
Yeah. And then, there's a chapter called The Law, which it takes place with a Helena, who is, what is that emperor's name? The one who had the dream.
Constantine.
Yeah, Constantine. His mother, right?
Mother.
Yeah. And she raced around the Holy Land finding these holy sites and declaring them, this is the place where this happened. This is the place where that happened. And kind of grabbing those places and making them pilgrimage sites, I guess you'd say. Putting churches on them.
Yeah. Just by her, I always thought that seemed a bit bogus. And this kind of that's fine in the sense that you can't really ever know. Often you don't know in a place of this antiquity where something actually happened. So when I'll see things like, and here's where they mostly agree Jesus was baptized. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think it's just enough for me to be here.
Yeah,
it happened somewhere. This is the place where it happened. It's like, did he stand right here?
Well, yeah, in both Diana's TV series and in Jesus, a Pilgrimage by Dr. Martin, Father Martin.
Yeah. I knew what you meant.
Was that a promotion or a demotion? I'm not sure. In both of them, they talk about that. Like, I remember Diana on the Via Dolorosa, she's saying, well, we're not sure.
Right.
It's positively, but it's really... no matter where you are, if you're following that, that road that Jesus took, that's what matters. But still, there's just something about being in a place. I recall Father Martin saying that when he was at a bath, with the arches, and they said, wow, this is almost absolutely definitely a place that Jesus was. And, right. And that's really moving. That's really moving.
Yeah, because I remember when this is within, oh my God, what, the last 10 or 15 years or something, people had, scholars who have sometimes done us more harm than good, of this historical let's connect everything,
mm-hmm.
had often said, well, Luke completely made this part up about these baths because of these big arches, that nobody ever built anything with the five arches like that. That was just, he was insane. He just did that. Then archaeologically, oh, here found it is, it. Right it. Here. We found it. Like, how many times do we have to be told we don't know everything we think we know? Sometimes you just have to go, and you can take it on faith in that sense. But, you know, it's like, look, one more time. Here it is.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing where, you just look at it and go, well, I don't know where he stood, but this is where he was. Right. So,
I just think that that's neat. And it is important to me that the Bible is accurate in a way. Talking about historically accurate, where you can point at these places. You know, Nazareth exists and Bethlehem exists and things. I don't know that I could be a member of a religion where you don't know where these places are. They're somewhere, but you know.
Well, that's true.
In all these times, you know, we still just don't know even where. You know, we know a general area maybe. But, you know, things don't seem to work out that way. But,
okay, I got carried away. Sorry.
I just love that fact that, those things
and
exist.
And once they do archaeological digs, the more they'll find things from way back, like Old Testament way back.
Yeah.
Which I think is actually really cool. Where you're like, oh,
really something.
I believed it, but whoa. You know, because that Bible is an amazing combination because it's so many different books. It's really what Bible means, library, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all these books of, you know, you've got the poetry, you have the existential thinking, which is like Ecclesiastes, you have the songs, you have just the general historical writings of the faith, and just kind of all of it through that lens of faith. So when you find the history, because that's not, they weren't writing the way we wrote to go. And here, if you measure 27 miles, you'll find this. They were writing to communicate something that people didn't even think to measure in that way then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really neat when they find something that, well, it still does connect with us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find that really valuable.
Yeah.
And as he's showing the development of religion, that's interesting too. He was talking about pork, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the ways that you could find out if your neighbor is Jewish or something like that. But it's interesting what the origin was. The origin was, you know, hey, that could probably kill you. You know,
but
if
that's,
you don't,
not really true. They
isn't
actually
it?
No.
Okay.
That's a popular recent way to describe it, but as our priest pointed out one time, he said, look at all the other cultures that ate it and it was fine.
Yeah, well, that's
the
true.
The reason was the faithfulness to God. This is how, it was like circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way to help you focus your own faith so that you understood where you were in relation to him. It's really, and because somebody brought that up in one of our Bible studies one time. He's like, yeah, that's a popular thing to say, but they didn't think that way. They understood what God told them. And that's one of those things, like making the law was, which is talked about a lot in this, it bound them into a people.
Hmm.
So.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
We should mention the Crusades. At least just touch on it. I think that you have, but they're very, very difficult chapters.
They're horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a few of them. So there, we mentioned them.
I know. Well, and he spent quite a lot of time showing all the persecution that came out of Europe, and I was simply horrified. And like Pope Francis, on behalf of my people, I can never apologize enough because this is just inhuman. But it was complete ignorance.
Yeah.
And there's no excuse on the part of the church for, except that there were ignorant people, you know, preaching these sermons that would send people out into the streets. And you're just like, you'd like to think everybody did a better job, but they did a crappy job and actual human beings suffered horribly and died, and it was awful.
Yeah, yeah.
On the other hand, I don't feel that Islam was really looked at in that same way. Mm-hmm. Of course, the book is pretty big.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, he talks about it. There's one called the Twilight. No, that's not it. Was it the Twilight of an Empire? No, that was about the Ottoman, A Day in the Life of a Desert Rider, where he's contrasting the old way of Muhammad and the new way, which is the nicer, kinder way of, well, if you convert, we won't kill you, instead of just coming in and killing everyone and saying it's ours. And there are a couple of books by Harold Lamb, who was really well known in the 20s and 30s for writing these really great historical fictions, or sometimes just straight histories. I read his book about Genghis Khan. It was amazing. And he was really adamant about, let's look at it from the context of the time, not just using the interpretation of the people who were writing, who might have been enemies of whoever you're talking about. So he did a really good job of that. But he wrote a book called, oh gosh, he's got two books about the Crusades. And one might be called The Flame of Islam, and the other's called like Iron Crosses and something. I'll find the names. But it basically tells the Crusades from both sides. Each book does.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always meant to read those so that you've got both sides, because there was good and bad on both sides.
Right.
We're shown the horrible stuff, and I think it's fair to show all that. Those people suffered a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to know all of it.
Yeah, there was a lot of that stuff in a book I read called Jerusalem. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a terrific book. Montefiore wrote it.
Right.
But you're exactly right. Yeah. And I would like to read some of that stuff by Harold Lamb, writing that down.
Yeah. He's on my list. I need to move him up. That list.
Oh, you bet.
It's killer.
The mighty list. The mighty list.
It's many pages in my notebook.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I don't know what else there is to say about this book. There's so much to say about it, but but again, I think it's very worthwhile. It is very long. But this is a book that could be written in pieces too. You could read a short story or novella or whatever, and then move on and come back and read the next one.
Yeah. My book club, after I read it, I was like, man, you guys, this says so much about kind of our faith and where it all came from and everything. And so what we're going to do is, it may all take us years, but every so often what we're going to do is, for our fiction time, we're going to schedule 200 pages. Or basically, we're going to read two of the novellas.
Uh-huh.
And so that's about 250. So that's like Great. A regular book. And then we'll come back.
Which ones did you decide on?
Oh, well, we're just going to start at the beginning and keep going, which is why it's going to take us years. And we'll stop. Mm-hmm. We do nonfiction, fiction. This is each month, a nonfiction, then next month a fiction, then we watch a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is a new edition that everybody really loves. And so maybe a couple times a year we might try The Source.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're able to put other fiction in the middle and everything.
That's cool. Yeah, it's a great way to do it. You know, why not?
We don't have to read it all in a row. And we've got some people who are slower readers. And so that way, if they want to read ahead, they can.
Yeah.
And if they don't, the fast readers are able to just knock it out and we can all talk about it at least.
Sure.
Which is kind of how we view that book club is we're the loosest book club in the world. As long as one or two people have read the book, and then everybody can talk about it. They just have to not mind, like this, hearing spoilers. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah. Thank you for picking it. You know. It was so good.
And thanks for reading it.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, yeah, I sure did like it. This is one of those books that you're glad to have read.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely was worthwhile. That's the best I can say about it.
And you also don't expect it to be sometimes beautiful. He could turn a lyric phrase that you don't expect when you think, and I would like to read one last little bit.
Okay.
Which is, from when they're fighting for freedom. And it's, Gottesman, I guess is how you say it. says, later when he had climbed to the hilltop, the snow ceased, and in the ensuing sunlight he saw for the first time the majestic hills of Galilee. How extraordinary they were in that wintry morning, brown in their barrenness, yet golden in the unexpected sunlight and tipped on each rise with silver from the snow. The convoluted hills twisted and turned in harmonious folds like the intricacies of music, dropping at last to the lake itself, now crystal blue in the distance. All his life, Gottesman had known of Galilee, but he had not known that it was beautiful.
Yeah, that's nice.
And that's, you hear constantly, it's beautiful. I hear that the Sea of Galilee is kind of this greenish blue and the hills are like this pinkish, you know, well, that's what James Martin said. This pinkish earth around it, and sounds gorgeous.
Cool. Yeah. That is fantastic.
Yeah. And, I had found on Goodreads this review by somebody who's Israeli.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
And I was really curious because they hadn't come across it. And they said, the research was amazing. It is hard to believe that a person who did not live here achieved such deep understanding of the historical, cultural, religious, and political issues related to the Jewish history. The scope is amazingly large. The book touches so many aspects related to Jewish history, Jewish religion and philosophy, Israeli history, and Israeli/Jewish politics and more. As an Israeli, most of the issues were not new to me, but the unusual way of presenting them was interesting and did help me understand my history better. It is interesting to be exposed to an external view of my history, culture, politics, etc. I'm not sure I agree with all the points of view expressed in the book, but they are generally accurate as far as I know, or at least accurate to the time they were written about 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's great.
I was pleased to see that, you know.
Nice.
So.
Well, good. Yeah.
And now I'll finally stop talking about
this. No, it's nice to know that. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good.
Like what you were saying about the Bible earlier. It's like, it's nice to know it's rooted in enough fact that it can be recognized from the outside too. Mm-hmm. So that what you're absorbing as fiction, but historical fiction, is relatively right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good. Okay. Well, in a couple of weeks, we've got Midnight in Paris.
Completely for free. Can you tell I was going in the other direction from Big and Long?
I love it. That's great. And then after that's a book.
Agents of the Stars.
Right, by John Scalzi. Cool. I've landed the audio version of that, read by Will Wheaton.
I really enjoyed that a lot.
Good, cool. So yeah. I'm going to listen to that.
Yeah.
Great. And then after that... Well, nothing's been picked yet, so I better get to doing that.
Yeah.
Well, I better get on that.
A religious movie?
Yeah, we'll do a religious movie. Yep.
Okay. And then your choices for book and maybe.
Right. Got it.
Wow, you've got a lot of choosing to do, sir.
I better get her done.
I know. Exciting.
Is Contact a religious movie?
As much as I would desperately love to watch it again, I haven't had my Matthew McConaughey fix lately.
All right. I love it. That is too funny.
All right. We didn't get to mention zombies. We did get to mention Matthew McConaughey.
That's right.
I touched him.
That's a win.
Yeah.
I
think I mentioned here, but if you haven't watched Mud with him in it, it was really excellent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I've got to watch it. Will
do. I can't recommend that. So I know you're pick your jaw up from where it's dropped. It was good.
I love it. That's great. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. And have a great couple of weeks.
Yep. You bet. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.